Via remote, I'm Liz Palka. Global coronavirus infection and death toll rates continue to creep upward as the United States still leads the world in both instances. In the U.S., the number of deaths approaches 89,000, while the number of confirmed infections is well over 1.4 million. A World Health Organization modeling study warns that nearly a quarter billion people will eventually be infected by the virus. The study also says that 150,000 people in Africa could die if urgent action is not taken. Published in the journal BMJ Global Health, the study projects lower infection rates and deaths in other parts of the world, such as Europe and the U.S. U.S. President Donald Trump tweeted Saturday that his administration is considering proposals pertaining to the World Health Organization. One proposal would see the U.S. pay the WHO 10% of what it used to contribute before Trump suspended contributions on April 14th. The president accused it of promoting China's quote-unquote disinformation about the outbreak. In Spain, the daily COVID-19 death toll dropped under 100 for the first time since the lockdown began in mid-March. Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez said that his government will seek a final four-week extension to its state of emergency as daily deaths from the coronavirus reached a near eight-week low. Less than a week after full lockdown measures were lifted, the Greek government reopened public beaches Saturday under strict social distancing rules. The government is thinking about reopening restaurants and bars on May 25th. Italy will also begin opening up this week, and tourists will be allowed into the country beginning on June 3rd. This is VOA News. A suicide bombing in central Somalia has killed a regional governor and at least four others on Sunday. VOA Somali has learned the governor of the Mudug region, Ahmed Mousseh Nur, was killed along with multiple bodyguards and others traveling with him. A civilian bystander was also killed. Mayor Saeed Mohamud Ali tells VOA the explosion happened after a suicide bomber driving a rickshaw rammed into the governor's vehicle in the town of Galkayo. The Al-Shabaab militant group has claimed responsibility for the attack. 20 civilians were killed in an overnight raid on a village in northeast Congo Sunday. It's the latest incident after a surge of ethnic violence that has forced 200,000 people from their homes the last 2 months. The fighters were from the Cooperative for the Development of the Congo militia group, part of the Lendu ethnic group. Local and army authorities said they attacked the village in Ituri province with machetes, then fled after United Nations peacekeepers arrived. Protests led to clashes between Albanian police and demonstrators on Sunday. Demolition of the country's national theater in the capital Tirana sparked the protests and led to 40 people being detained. Police pulled a group of protesting artists away from the building before heavy machinery pulled the structure down. Artists and activists have been protesting the plan to demolish the World War II era building for 2 years, rejecting Socialist Prime Minister Idi Rama's plans to build a new one. Protesters accused him of corrupt practices. Wuhan health officials say the city conducted 222,000 nucleic acid tests on Saturday. The Chinese city, where the new coronavirus outbreak originated, kicked off a campaign on Friday to look for asymptomatic carriers of the virus. Health officials say the amount of people tested on Saturday doubled from the day prior. China and South Korea are said to have consulted Japan about easing border controls on business travelers to help revive business activities. The idea, already implemented between South Korea and China, would allow a fast-track entry of business people if they test negative for the new coronavirus before departure and after arrival. But Tokyo is cautious about relaxing border controls at this point due to fears of another spike in infections, as well as lack of test kits for travelers, according to a report. We have more stories for you on voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Liz Palka, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
So we want justice to be done and to be done in our country. And we want the suspect of genocide to come to Rwanda and the first justice in Rwanda. It's exactly our preference.
The vice president of the Genocide Survivors Association welcomes the arrest of the financier of the Rwandan genocide.
We have to live, we have to survive. And when time to mend diplomatic relations comes, we will mend them. But as for now, we must be alive and keep our country safe from COVID-19, whatever it takes.
Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta imposes border restrictions to curb the spread of the coronavirus.
Now it's almost 10 years since he is in power. We still don't have electricity daily, despite the fact that he has spent more than $3 billion. So it tells you that it doesn't matter for him, but you know, sooner or later, this will end for sure.
And Amnesty International expresses concern about human rights abuses in Guinea. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. President Uhuru Kenyatta has announced a 30-day closure of the country's borders with Tanzania and Somalia. The restrictions, which began early Sunday morning, forms part of the administration's effort to halt the spread of the novel coronavirus. The president says 43 of the recent confirmed cases of the disease have come across the border from Somalia and Tanzania. The border closures have generated mixed reaction. Some welcome the move, saying it is a significant step in the fight against the spread of the disease. Others, however, say the president should have acted sooner. They argue that the authorities in neighboring Tanzania have not been transparent in the fight against the disease. Mwenda Mbijiwe, a Kenyan security analyst, tells me the border closures are a welcome development that could strengthen the fight to halt the spread of the disease.
Yes, this is a decision which is very timely. We congratulate the president of Kenya for being this bold. It is intended to stop cross-border movement of citizens of the countries of Tanzania and Somalia. Previously, there have been cases in Kenya from Somalia and cases in Kenya from Tanzania. And so this is a very timely decision, and I thank God that our president was exactly very bold at this time. This is a decision, however, that he should have taken several weeks or months ago. But anyway, it is never too late, and this is intended to stop the movement of coronavirus across the border. And I congratulate the president of Kenya for taking this bold step.
But how effective do you think the implementation of the closures of the borders will be? And how will this curtail the spread of the coronavirus as the government anticipated to be?
I have absolutely no doubt in my mind that this implementation is going to be very effective, because if you look at all the measures government has put in place since the first case was reported in Kenya, the measures have been immensely and extremely effective. In fact, so effective that even our Minister for Health has been hailed by American media as one of the best and shining examples in Africa of how to lead from the front. So there is absolutely no doubt that this is going to be thoroughly effective. The Minister of Health has been spot on the implementation of these measures, and this is thoroughly going to be affected, just like everything else has been affected, including the lockdown in Nairobi, you know, the zoning Eastleigh and other areas. So it's going to be very effective.
In your view, what are the implications of this enforcement of the restrictions imposed at the borders?
This is a brilliant question, because the two borders that have been closed host communities that live in both countries. So you find inside Kenya, on the Tanzanian side, is a community called Maasai. They're in Kenya and they're in Tanzania across the border. Same as Somalia, there are Somali Kenyans on the Kenyan side and Somali in Somalia on the Somalia side. So the implications here are immense. Even families are going to have to be separated. Relatives are not going to be able to cross over to each other's side. The same will happen in Tanzania, where the Maasai is a nomadic community. Even they will not be able to cross the border with their cattle to either side. And so these are immense implications.
In your view, what are the implications of this enforcement of the restrictions imposed at the borders?
Yeah, it's possible that there'll be diplomatic implications and could hurt relations. But this is happening even in families. Families have had to be separated, you know, husbands and wives and children. Recently, we lost a very prominent Kenyan whose wife and children could not even attend his burial. So, because of COVID-19. So, yes, there'll be implications, but the most important thing is for people to be alive. In fact, we can mend all these diplomatic problems. I mean, which country in the world is going to have greater diplomatic problems with the rest of the world than China because of COVID-19? But again, we have to live, we have to survive. And when time to mend diplomatic relations comes, we will mend them. But as for now, we must be alive and keep our country safe from COVID-19, whatever it takes.
Mwenda Mbijewe is a Kenyan security analyst. He spoke with me from the capital, Nairobi. In Rwanda, the vice president of the Genocide Survivors Association says the arrest of a key mastermind of the genocide is a significant step in the quest to seek justice for victims and survivors. Freddy Matunguhu says genocide survivors want the arrested leader expatriated to Rwanda to face justice for his alleged crimes. His remarks come after French authorities announced the arrest of Felicien Kabuga, known as the financier of the 1994 genocide. Saturday, Kabuga was a close ally of former President Juvenal Habyarimana. The shooting down of the president's plane in 1994 is believed to have sparked the 100-day massacre. At least 800,000 Tutsis and moderate Hutus were killed in the genocide. Freddy Mutanguhu, vice president of the Genocide Survivors Association, tells me that the arrest of Kabuga is a monumental achievement which brings hope to genocide survivors.
This is the good news. Kabuga's arrest is a moment of hope. Those suspect of planning and funding the murder of our beloved ones will face justice at least. Kabuga is one of the actors of genocide against the Tutsi in Rwanda in 1994, which cost lives of more than a million of innocent Tutsis. He also funded the network of import of arms and machetes used in the genocide. He financed the Radio Television de Mille Collines, LTLM, as a hate radio that spread a hatred against Tutsi around the country and inciting the extremist Hutus to kill our families. So we feel that is very good news, and he have done a lot of things to implement genocide in this country. He should face the justice, and we hope that Kabuga will be brought, extradited to Rwanda, so that he can face the justice where he committed genocide. We are all looking for that.
Freddie, how are people reacting to this, and what does his arrest mean to the survivors of the genocide?
Kabuga escaped justice for so long, 26 years now, but his arrest today in France, it's a great evidence and it's a moment of hope for survivors that those who committed the suspect of genocide and those who planned and funded genocide can face justice today. It's a great moment indeed. But also survivors, we hope that the cooperation between countries will be made to bring those suspects, including Kabuga, to Rwanda to face a justice where he committed a genocide. But we also hope that other suspects of genocide, those who've been involved in genocide, will be also arrested and be brought to face justice in Rwanda or at international criminal courts for Rwanda.
Well, due to the COVID-19, it looks like he might not leave France anytime soon until the pandemic is resolved before he could be moved to face trial. But how does this impact the justice that survivors seek?
Kabuga was arrested today, and this is really in the middle of a pandemic. We hope that France will find a way to advance this case despite the difficulties of this pandemic of COVID-19. And I've seen examples in Rwanda where the courts have continued their work and people are given justice, even if today, where we are facing the COVID-19 situation. I think and I hope, and all survivors hope, that France, as a very advanced country and a developed country, will find a way and resolve and also deal with this case and quickly.
I understand the victims or survivors of the genocide will prefer him to be returned to Rwanda to face justice where the crime occurred. Is this your preference, or is this what survivors have been telling you?
This is our preference. The survivors wish that Kabuga should be brought to Rwanda to face justice in Rwanda, where he committed genocide. He should come where survivors who have seen and witnessed his action at the time of genocide, where they will give more testimonies. We also have seen the challenges of ICTR and other courts, international courts, to collect evidences. All evidences are based here in Rwanda. So we want justice to be done and to be done in our country. And we want the suspect of genocide to come to Rwanda and the first justice in Rwanda. It's exactly our preference. We hope that France will follow the example of other countries and the ICTR to extradite Kabuga Félicien to Rwanda to face justice in Rwanda, because other countries have done it. We have seen many examples, and then Rwanda have shown the capacity and capability to provide a fair trial to those suspects of genocide. This is the case of Zhao Inkindi, Bernard Munyagishari, and Ladislas Ntaganzwa, and others who have been extradited to Rwanda. And today, they are facing a very fair trial, and they are facing the justice where they committed genocide, and where survivors can be able to provide all testimonies to those who are suspected of genocide.
Freddy Mutanguhu is the vice president of the Genocide Survivors Association. He spoke with me from the capital, Kigali. A prominent Ugandan human rights activist have expressed concern that the government is using state institutions to intimidate and harass opponents and those with dissenting views. Attorney Isaac Semakadi also says he will continue to defend clients in an effort to prevent the government from abusing the rights of citizens to free speech guaranteed by the Constitution. This after he was recently arrested for social media postings criticizing a judicial appointment. Among the charges he faces include cyber harassment, criminal libel, and offensive communication. Critics say he has a case to answer for violating the laws aimed at maintaining the country's peace and stability. Reacting to the charges against him, Attorney Semakadi tells me that his arrest and the charges against him appear to be part of the plan to intimidate him. He adds that he will not be deterred in his effort to ensure the fundamental rights of all Ugandans are protected, irrespective of their political affiliation.
At about noon on the 7th of May, I had just, as I was leaving court from receiving a ruling concerning the rights of advocates in Uganda to move freely and access their clients to protect their constitutional rights during the coronavirus pandemic, I observed that I was under unlawful surveillance.
Isaac, did the officers who arrested you give you a reason behind the arrest?
Unfortunately, I wasn't given a reason at the time of the arrest. Just outside the High Court premises in Kampala, the capital of Uganda, I was beset by about 15 uninformed security operatives with about 3 or 4 cars that I could notice. And 5 of them accosted me and threw me into a waiting saloon car, which had other escort cars, and they drove me to the headquarters of the Directorate of Crime and Intelligence for the Uganda Police Force. That's where, at about 1 p.m., that I got to learn the reason that I was under arrest on general accusations in terms of sections 24 and 25 of the Computer Misuse Act of Uganda. When I pressed for particulars, I was actually shown a charge sheet which was already waiting for me. And the charge sheet seemed to allege that the certain Twitter activity attributed to me had been deemed offensive in terms of our cyber harassment law and offensive communication law, and in terms of criminal libel, insofar as it concerned comments I made about the incoming director of public prosecution, Justice Jane Francis Abodo.
Isaac, your critics are saying that you broke the law, and if you break the law, you should face the consequences as enshrined in the laws of Uganda. How do you respond to that?
First and foremost, I don't think I broke any laws in Uganda. And it will be a hard stretch for any government official to try to go that far. My attorneys have written to the Uganda Law Society and explained that the tweet at issue constitutes protected opinion and does not reasonably imply what the president of the Uganda Law Society, what the judge, prosecutor and her predecessors, what the Uganda women's lawyers allege. This is fair comment. This is protected comment. This is a stinging criticism of a public institution and a public officer. Of course, the vagina is a very emotive subject. It's a very contested space within Ugandan political and public discourse. And it is bound to bring emotions that will cloud the judgment of some sections of Uganda's elitist society. But the substance of the criticism remains, and it's my protection. It is not illegal to criticize an officer in a very robust, provocative, or raw manner. There's no illegality here. And I await any accusation in any forum in Uganda or elsewhere. This is intended merely to obscure the substance of the complaint that the Department of the Public Prosecutor has a long track record of failing to uphold the rights of suspects in police custody, the rights of suspects in courtrooms. It disrespects and abuses the rule of law. And we should do more. If there is a new public officer, she should listen to what we think is wrong about this process, this her office. Yeah.
Some Ugandans are saying the police were just carrying out their duty by enforcing the law, and that you have been charged, you should go to court to answer those charges. They said your accusations of harassment and or intimidation by the police are regrettable and insincere. Your reaction to that?
No, I disagree. The police treated me shabbily, and it was designed to be that way. The unit of the police that was in charge of enforcing this arrest is a unit I'm familiar with, since I'm a specialist in computer misuse laws of Uganda. I have worked for several clients who have dealt with this office. They have served on me previously a number of summons to on behalf of my clients, and I have been able to accompany my clients to their headquarters for interviews and so on, including Dr. Stella Nyanzi. And in fact, sometime last year, we won a very big case. My client, Dr. Nyanzi, was given $12,000 as damages because of police harassment. She had attended a police interview sometime in 2017, on the 7th of March 2017, but the police molested her on the 19th of March at the airport when she was traveling to Amsterdam. And the court said this was uncalled for. It was high-handed, unnecessary. So because she had already interfaced with the police and been released. So these people know me. I'm a prominent advocate in this country. They could have served me through the formal channels. They could have served me with court process, with any summons, any invitation letter to come to police, to bring myself to police. They could have come to court where I was. I was performing a service on behalf of the entire law society. We had a very important court proceeding happening. I was within colleagues who are law-abiding. They could have told me that after this activity, we need you and we want you to accompany us to police and attend to this matter.
Attorney Isaac Samakade is a prominent Ugandan human rights activist. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. In Guinea, opposition and civil society groups say human rights violations cited in the latest Amnesty International report is a true reflection of the situation in the West African country. The recent report expressed concern the authorities are using arbitrary arrests of activists to silence dissent. It cited the use of excessive force by the security forces to stop protests against the constitutional amendment. Attorney Thiano Sulemani Balde is a member of the National Opposition Front for the Defense of the Constitution and president of the Board of Research Institute on Democracy and Rule of Law. He tells me that it is clear that the Guinean government will simply ignore Amnesty International's criticism of the country's continuous gross human rights violations.
We have had so many other reports, but so far the government is just ignoring any need to make an independent investigation, because they know exactly who are killing the innocent Guineans. The government is connected by the rule of impunity. As long as it's the security forces, they have immunity de facto. Otherwise, those people who have killed innocent civilians in Koya, some of them, they have been identified physically. So there's no need to make a difficult investigation, but the government won't. This regime doesn't care about any of the Guineans as long as they can keep doing what they enjoy most, corrupting the system, getting as rich as possible and as quickly as possible. This is what they are concerned about. Otherwise, they don't care about the Guinean people.
What do you say to those Guineans who support the government and who are of the view that the latest Amnesty report is not a true reflection of what is happening in the country at the moment?
This is not the will of the majority of the Guineans. Everyone knows the president is using the security forces to oppress, intimidate and harass the Guinean people. The 22nd March elections, in some of the cities, they didn't get more than 3,000 votes, while the total of voters were more than 100,000. This is just to tell you, the government doesn't have the legitimacy. They are using force to intimidate. This is not just also one part of the Guinea. If you take even in the cities where the government is supposed to have the stronghold, for example, in Kankan, in Kurusa, in Kerwani, even in those cities, there are demonstrations. The only difference, the security forces kill people only when it's the other cities, when it's Kankan or where the government is supposed to be the most influential political party, they let it go. But otherwise, this is not the issue about, you know, the majority of Guineans. This government is collapsing, and before they get the end of the bottom, they have, you know, unfortunately, to kill more Guineans.
Supporters of the government are of the view that the Amnesty International report is biased because the security agencies are just enforcing measures the government has put in place to stop the spread of the coronavirus. And some people are purposely ignoring and violating these measures, which will encourage the spread of the disease among Guineans.
You may say some of the government supporters, and we know also how it works, because they are always manipulating people to make it sound like they have supporters who are backing them with their policies, which is not the case. Even in the cities where you have the strong support for the ruling party, people are demonstrating. This is not just about demonstration against the measures that the government has been taking for the COVID-19. It's also a matter of lack of electricity, water. People don't have the basic social means to survive. So this is why, you know, people are demonstrating. And it's not just in one part of the country. It's all over the country.
Well, Thiano, some Guineans are suggesting that the latest Amnesty report is unlikely to have any meaningful impact on the government or the current situation on the ground.
What are your thoughts?
I agree with them because so far, despite all of the international concern, if you take the ECOWAS position, the African Union position, the French position, the U.S. position, I mean all the international committee position, and you take all of main human rights organizations, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and so on, and the local organization as well. It's the same. Mr. Alpha Conde is not listening to anyone. He has an agenda, how to get his third term in power. He doesn't care how many people will be killed or how many Guineans will be suffering. As long as he cannot get to his objective, he's fine. Otherwise, if you take, now it's almost 10 years since he is in power. We still don't have electricity daily, despite the fact that he has spent more than $3 billion. So it tells you that it doesn't matter for him, but you know, sooner or later, this will end for sure.
Attorney Thiano Sulemani Balde is a member of the opposition National Front for the Defense of the Constitution and president of the Board of Research Institute on Democracy and Rule of Law. He spoke with me from the Guinean capital, Conakry. This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Douglas Impuga, and music from our African collection. But first, Zambia's main opposition United Party for National Development, or UPND, says the government has been inconsistent in the fight to stop the spread of the novel coronavirus. The party says the administration has failed to carry out measures to halt the spread of the disease. This after local media reports the government has begun opening parts of the informal sector, including tourist attractions. But some Zambians say the government continues to engage citizens through public education and regular updates. Supporters of the ruling party accuse the UPND of playing politics. Charles Kakoma, spokesperson for the main opposition UPND, tells me that the administration has not been strategic in the fight against the disease. He says protective equipment and clothing are expensive and hard to find, despite contributions from citizens and companies to help in the fight against the disease.
The United Party for National Development, UPND, the largest opposition political party in Zambia, is concerned with the way the Zambian government is going about implementing measures to do with the coronavirus. The government is highly inconsistent and in many cases undecided on what to do. They seem not to know what to do to contain the coronavirus. Before COVID-19 came to Zambia, we consistently urged the ruling party to lock down the country, to close the international airports and so on, all the border entry points. They refused. And now the coronavirus came, and we urged them to lock down Lusaka, where the first cases of the coronavirus appeared, and they refused. Now the virus has spread to all the parts of the country, and we are seeing a situation where the cases are rising, and the government is opening up many sectors of the economy to start freely trading, such as the tourism sector at Livingstone, where the famous Victoria Falls is located. If you come to Lusaka, people have been freely trading in the markets, and there has been no control. In many parts of Zambia, many people are walking the streets freely. There are no face masks, and the testing facilities are not adequate. Quarantine centers are something not to be proud of. Many people are running away from the quarantine centers because there's hunger. And therefore, the government has been inconsistent. At the time when the cases are rising, during this week, we had the highest number of cases in Zambia. But this is the time when they are also announcing opening up the economy even more. The fear among many Zambians is that this coronavirus is going to be uncontrollable and wipe out many Zambians.
But Charles, the government officials are saying that they routinely and constantly update Zambians about the current situation of the disease and measures being implemented to cut the spread, which they said have been successful so far. So these criticisms, they said, are regrettable.
It is true that the Zambian government is holding press briefings to update the country on the current status of the COVID fight. But those updates are not helping anyone because these cases continue to rise, and all they are doing is just to report on the rising cases of the coronavirus. And therefore, the coronavirus is continuing to spread throughout the country. So if they are claiming that those updates are a success story, how come that the virus is continuing to spread while they are still updating? If the measures they are taking are being successful, how come that the cases are rising? According to the health minister himself, we have not even reached the peak yet. The worst is still to come. So if the worst is still to come, can the measures that they are taking be said to be effective? The answer is no. And that is why we are saying the government doesn't know what they are doing. They are so inconsistent, and this is going to endanger the lives of many people. Right now, they are receiving donations, for example, of face masks, and people have no access to those face masks. They are so expensive in the private pharmacies, and therefore poor people cannot afford. People cannot afford hand sanitizers, and yet they are receiving donations every day. So what is happening to those hand sanitizers? At a time when people need water to constantly wash their hands, they need soap. In many parts of this country, people have difficulties accessing water. People have difficulties accessing soap. So how do they fight the coronavirus? What measures have they put in place to fight the coronavirus? All we're seeing is that the government ministers are getting relief food and distributing to people, making it like a campaign tool. They are campaigning for people to vote for them in the coming elections next year and by-elections that are happening now. So that cannot be said to be effective measures.
But Charles, some people are of the view that the cure should not be more than the disease itself, and that there's need to gradually open economic activities to ensure that people meet their livelihood and get some money in their pockets.
It is true that people need some money in order to survive, but the issue is that this should not be done in a reckless manner. We have a situation where the government allowed cross-border trade between Zambia and Tanzania. And the other border between Zambia and Tanzania, well, the government did not even know that coronavirus was spreading. And we have one of the highest cases. In fact, the highest case has been reported from the border between Zambia and Tanzania. Why they didn't control the border, no one knows. Even if the people have to trade, they should trade in a safe environment. In many places now in Zambia, for example, some of the people that need to survive, need to trade, are what we call the marketeers, people that are selling vegetables and other small items at the market. But the markets are overcrowded. And in an overcrowded place, you cannot expect to control coronavirus. Some of the people that need to survive are those that are in the transport sector, minibuses, small minibuses and taxis. But the people that are in this sector, they are overloading the buses. They are overcrowded. And there are no safe measures to ensure that there is safe transportation, even as they are making money. And this is how the virus is spreading. Always telling government that let them manage the situation. Let them put in place measures that are effective and not just reporting cases, not just allowing anyone, every Jim and Jack, to start trading the way they want to trade. Because the experience has shown that that is contributing to the spread of virus. And if they deny that, well, they continue to live in denial while the cases are rising.
Charles, some people are of the view that the government gradually opening economic spaces in phases is one responsible way of ensuring that people get back to work while limiting the spread of the coronavirus. And they said the criticisms appear to be politically motivated. How do you respond to that?
Yes. In fact, in the Zambian situation, one can argue that the major sectors of the economy were never closed. The mining sector, for example, is a major sector in Zambia, which contributes more than 80% of the country's foreign exchange earnings. And the mines were never closed, even amidst the outbreak of the coronavirus. They continued functioning. The manufacturing industry continued functioning. They are not closed. The farms and other agricultural activities were never closed. We are talking about mainly activities in the informal sector, involving small-scale business people. These are the ones, in the first place, they were never closed, except, for example, only those running bars and restaurants. But even as they are opening these, we are arguing that the safety of the people, the health of the people comes first. We should not risk the health of the people in order to open up economic activity. In the end, when there are no people, because they are dead, there will be no economy to talk about.
Charles Kakoma is the spokesperson for the Zambian main opposition UPND. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. DRC is the latest African country to cancel its football season before completion. The executive committee of the DR Congo Football Association met Wednesday in Kinshasa and decided to end its competitions. Giant TP Mazembe were named champions. When the season was halted, Mazembe led with 53 points, 5 ahead of arch rivals AS Vita. The two will represent DR Congo in the CAF Champions League 2020-2021 season. Meanwhile, AS Maniema Union and DC Motema Pembe, who were third and fourth respectively in the standings, will represent the country in the Toto CAF Confederation Cup. In neighboring Cameroon, PWD Bamenda have been named champions of the Elite One League and will represent Cameroon in the CAF Champions League next year. The decision by the executive committee comes 2 months after all football activities were initially stopped due to COVID-19. PWD, based in the northwestern Cameroon region, will make history by playing in a CAF competition for the first time ever. With 47 points after 28 games, PWD were top of the standings, a point above second-placed Cotton Sport, while Colombe were third in the standings with 45 points. There will be no relegation, and the league will be expanded to accommodate 20 teams instead of 18. Meanwhile, CAF has resolved to accelerate the payment of the final tranche of financial rewards to participating clubs in CAF inter-club competitions for the 2019-2020 season. The distribution, which has since started, is to reduce the financial burden on the 32 clubs that reach the group stages of the CAF Champions League and CAF Confederation Cup. Clubs will receive their dues based on the established prize monies for each competition till the quarter-final stage, when the two competitions were suspended indefinitely due to COVID-19. The minimum guaranteed for clubs participating in the CAF Champions League is $500,000 and $275,000 for the CAF Confederation Cup. In athletics, the anniversary games in London have been cancelled because of coronavirus pandemic, according to UK Athletics. London Stadium had been scheduled to host the event, also part of the Diamond League season, on July 4th to 5th. Meanwhile, the Diamond League season will now run between August and October. The shortened calendar means the point system has also been revised. Athletes will not earn points this season, and there will not be a single 24-discipline final in Zurich as originally planned. Along with the London event, Rabat and Zurich have also been cancelled.
In professional golf, the PGA Tour has outlined its plans for return to action. However, leading professional golfers based outside the United States must quarantine in America before resuming the PGA Tour season next month. There has been no play at the circuit since the abandonment of the Players' Championships on March 12th. Around 25 players eligible to play the Charles Schwab Colonial event in Texas, which will be held on June 11th to 14th, are currently living outside the United States. The PGA Tour is increasingly confident its season will resume behind closed doors at the Colonial event in Fort Worth, Texas, on June 11th. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Bembea, 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 b she done joined. Now let me talk what seems to me that you don't know how much you mean to me. That sucks, sucks, sucks. Because no one can take you.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington, D.C. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoyed the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Saleh, reporter Douglas Mpuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, a forewarned battle will not kill a clever cripple. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
This is VOA News.